All right, great. So anyway, thank you. I'd like to talk about some work that I've done past couple years about gravitational waves and exploring the strongly curved side of the universe. I'm going to try to jump around a little bit. So the main emphasis of my talk will be on binary black holes, the LIGO-Virgo detections, how they can be used to test general relativity, and then one interesting application, one prediction of GR, the gravitational wave memory effects, which I think are an exciting tie-in between gravitational waves and fundamental physics. Then towards the end, I'll talk about the recent detection of a binary neutron star by LIGO and Virgo. And then the last two points are some future directions I'm thinking about, which I'll just return to at the end, about looking for a stochastic background of gravitational waves through astrometry, and then possibly learning about dark matter through gravitational wave in spirals. So I think probably LIGO is something that doesn't need too much introduction here, but this is the three LIGO detectors, Hanford, Livingston, and then the Virgo detector in Italy. This is sort of the noise sensitivity, so the kinds of strains you can hope to measure, and then probably in terms of more physical units, how far out you can see. So the best performing detector was the Livingston one, which had a binary neutron star horizon, so the furthest binary neutron star that could see of about 200 megaparsecs. And then Hanford and Virgo together were a little less good because of various technical noise issues. But the idea is that the LIGO and Virgo detectors were able to achieve amazing sensitivity and could see strains on sort of the, let's say, actually, rather than strains, the absolute distances and sort of the attometer kinds of scales. So what are the sources that LIGO is looking for? They're compact binaries, which I'm probably won't surprise anyone when I flip to the next slide and show the detections. But then they're also looking for things like continuous waves. So you have a lump on a rotating neutron star, or stochastic backgrounds at high frequencies. And then, of course, they're also going to be looking for unmodeled sources in case there's any surprises lurking out there in the universe, gravitational waves. So what has LIGO found so far? It's just found the compact binary sources, and probably the one you've heard most recently about.
So I guess maybe I should say something. So that you showed the picture of CMB and say it's an unmodeled source. Arguably, it's the best model source in physics is the CMB, so you could.
Yeah, sorry. The heading here is stochastic background.
That's not the unmodeled source.
Yeah, and then unmodeled source. I didn't have a picture because I'm not sure what I'm looking for. But yeah, I agree.
So it's fudgy. You sweep it unmodeled under the slide.
Yeah. Okay, so as you probably heard, there's now been one binary neutron star detection. And depending on how you count, 5 or 6. So these four are the confident LIGO-Virgo detections. This is the first detection by both, first jointly. Should I pause for a moment?
Well, while we pause, can I ask you a quick question about this?
Yeah.
There are these little jet features in the black hole.
Do you mean these things?
Are those supposed to be spin?
No, these are just the uncertainties on the mass measurement. So, yeah, unfortunately, the units seem to have been cut off, but 80 is 80 solar masses, and then there's no significance here. So basically, this is on a log scale. So this just gives you a sense of how precisely. So for these lower mass black holes, right, it looks a little larger, but I'll jump to an actual contour plot where you can see the range of masses. But what I'd like to focus on mostly is the binary black holes, because these are sort of general relativity's simplest objects and are going to be useful for testing the predictions of general relativity in the most strongly gravitating and dynamical regime. So why, for example, is it interesting to do this? And I think this is a nice figure, which probably several of you have seen, which is sort of where has general relativity been tested in terms of the space of curvature. So going to shorter length scales up here, and then in terms of the dynamical regime. So this has been represented by the binding energy, divided by its time derivative. So it's supposed to represent how rapidly is the system losing energy to gravitational waves. Right, so Einstein's prediction of the perihelion precession of Mercury is, which sort of confirmed general relativity for, as the, it was one of the most first predictions that was confirmed.
That's right. A post-diction, that was.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Yeah, to be technical, it is a post-diction, yes, yes. Right, this happens on length scales that are relatively long, and it basically it's saying Mercury would never merge into the sun due to gravitational waves, right? And then similarly, lunar laser ranging, another test, but let's just jump right to the double binary pulsar, right? Even this will take billions of years to have its orbit significantly change and merge. And the length scales are actually relatively large. So the question is, where do the binary black holes lie on this? I think you can guess, right? They're sort of merging on sub-second time scales, and they're probing, as the two black holes merge, they get sort of to within the horizon distance, so they're probing much shorter curvature length scales. So the point of this figure is just that I think it's useful to point out that whenever you have a theory and it hasn't been tested in a certain range of the parameter space, I think it's just simply an interesting question to test the theory and see what are the predictions and do they hold up. Yes?
Cassini is very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
The Cassini test.
Yes. Yeah, but in some sense, that's a stationary test because it's just measuring. Yeah. So it's, you know, towards infinity on this plot. But yeah. Yeah, so. Did you have a.
Yeah, so I was going to ask a question about this. So I think I understand why curvature's important. Mm-hmm. Even if kilometers might not be the relevant unit. Is it obvious that the time scale is also an important quantity in this? Or, you know, is there maybe something like the time scale in units of the curvature? Or like, is it obvious that the time scale just measured in seconds is, you know, the most physically interesting element in this plot?
I think just how much, maybe a better way to represent it would be how much power is going into gravitational waves. And I think if you plotted that instead of time scale, it would have the same effect that it's off the charts, right? I mean, this is, it's really the sort of, both the nonlinear that these things are so close together and strongly interacting, and therefore they're producing so much gravitational waves that they're changing rapidly. So I think you could also plot in terms of power, and maybe that would be a little more physical from your perspective. So then there's the question, if you're going to test general relativity, right, how accurately can you measure things like the masses and what are the predictions? And the point of this plot is just to summarize the five detections and then the one that's only 90% confident with the curious LVT name. And right, the idea is that based on this, you're not going to be able to get, say, 1% precision based on the current accuracy of individual LIGO detections. So you're going to have to do some more clever things to get more precise predictions, more precise tests of general relativity. So I was involved in one such test. And to describe it, I just want to review a little terminology about how gravitational wave people talk about the binary merger. So there's sort of three stages. There's the in-spiral, where the two objects are widely separated. And as a result, the gravitational waves increase in both amplitude and in frequency until they come to the merger stage. And this is where sort of general relativity is most dynamical and where it has been tested least. So you'd expect if there's some deviation from general relativity, it would appear here. Then finally, there's the ring down where you have just a quiescent black hole and it's emitting some exponentially decaying modes. And this, again, you can understand just from doing perturbative calculations with black holes. So it would be nice to have a test that is focused on looking for deviations around the merger. And this is what we tried to formulate. So the idea is that if you do numerical relativity simulations of merging black holes, you have a very precise idea of what the final mass and final spin is based on the initial masses and spins. So if you only use a portion of the waveform, up to before the merger, you can then predict what the final mass and spin would be. And that's what this contour is right here. Then you can just simply use the remainder of the waveform from the merger after. And that's just related to sort of the quasi-normal mode ringing. And that's going to give you another set of contours based on the data for the final mass and spin. And then just as a consistency check, if you use the entire waveform and get the final mass and spin, this gives you the third region. And nicely, they're all consistent for the first event, the GW150914.
Well, this is a very nice test, but it could have been done in a deeper fashion, right? So here you, Lyo went and matched the complete waveform, mm-hmm. and then the best match, then you chop it and analyze independently. But it would have been different from saying, I'm going to use an Inspiral, do the match, mm-hmm. a completely different one that is a bring down, do the match, and then see if the parameters agree. I mean, have you guys tried doing that?
I'm not sure I understand.
So
you did the best match
mm-hmm. of a full waveform.
Of the full waveform. And then this contour, the Inspire one, is just up to a given frequency.
Sure. And but then, so that waveform, it could have been the case that if you only look for...
No, you redo the parameter estimation and get the contours, right? You don't choose the best fit one for the Inspire merger. You redo the full parameter estimation for waveforms up to that frequency, and that gives this contour. And then you repeat the exercise with the post-merger, and you don't use the full waveform. You again just use post-merger waveforms, and you get the second contour.
Okay.
So I think we're doing what you were suggesting.
So but just to be clear, when is it up to some frequency? Is it, you mean up to some time or up to some frequency? How do you decide where to, how to split the data, basically?
It's actually done in the frequency domain. Yeah.
For a bit.
So yeah, that you just Fourier transform your templates and then you put the cut in the frequency domain as opposed to the time domain.
Okay. And the same with the data, you just fit the data in frequency domain in. I mean, one model to high frequency and one model to low frequency is up here.
Yeah, yeah.
Why is the Inspiral phase bigger? I would expect that you can constrain the parameters better during the Inspiral then.
It's just for this first event, it was so high mass that you basically only had four cycles or so, and then you just had a couple cycles more. So in this case, you actually, for the lower mass events, what you're saying is correct, but for the high mass ones, it's less good.
What about measuring the spins? A1, A2.
What about
the measurement of the spins?
Yeah, that's harder because that is a higher order effect. You measure, if you think in terms of an expansion of the phase of the gravitational waves in a low velocity limit, then the effect of the spins comes in at third order in some sense in V over C, and V over C cubed basically. Whereas the masses are one power lower, so you just don't measure them as well. But so the idea though is that, right, if you just have this single event, it's hard to get good constraints. But the idea is you want some quantity that you can compare between different observations so that you can combine the measurements and ultimately get better constraints. So the idea is to then look at differences between the final mass measured from the in-spiral part and the post-in-spiral part. And then similarly for the final spin. And then again, this isn't going to be something you can naturally compare. So you then want to normalize by, say, the most probable value, this quantity m bar f, and similarly for the spin. And then this is something that you can compare. And right, what it's basically saying is, in principle, how much extra energy could have been emitted around the time of merger and still be consistent with the data, different from what GR predicts. And same thing for the spin. So this is what it looks like. These are the contours in blue for the GW150914 event, and then in purple for the January event of last year. And as you can see, if you combine them, you get this black contour right here. And essentially, from the two events, you're constraining, say, the mass to sort of the 10% level, roughly. These are 90% confidence intervals. And then for the spin, it's more sort of like 20%. Ever.
You're not measuring the final mass in the spiral, so you're using then you use theory there based on the initial individual parameters.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell you what the mass final mass should be, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What they are when you're measuring the final mass.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, so there is numerical relativity that comes in.
That's I don't care about that. I mean, I'm just saying, so in one case you're using your GR knowledge to predict what the final mass would be, and the other one you're actually measuring the final mass, and that's what you're subtracting.
So the other one you're still using a general relativity template.
But of the final, of the post-merger object. Well, I'm trying to understand what you mean by in spiral final mass. So because you don't have access to the final mass in the spiral.
Yeah, so it's through numerical relativity. So you basically get estimates of M1, M2, and the spins, and then you use that mapping from numerical relativity. Yeah. But the final point that I just wanted to make was that although from two events you have these kinds of constraints, as you stack more events together, typically the errors will grow with 1 over the square root of n. So when you have 100, which I think will happen in the next 5 to 10 years, then you're starting to put 1 to 2% constraints in general relativity. And that's where I think it gets more interesting.
So you said you put a frequency cut for the in-spiral, and then for the ring down. I assume you do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you determine the frequency cut from one event to the next? And why? I guess it's the same thing. I mean, you have an estimate for the mass. You could put, like a radius cut, right? But that I guess that would be the same thing as a frequency. No. Radius cut. That will be model dependent because you'll have different masses, right? So you'll say outside of 10m or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you select in a uniform way the frequency cut from one event to the next, or even within a single event?
Yeah, I mean, so you do sort of use the IMR waveform, and then you say, based on this, you just use the frequency of sort of the ISCO of the final object as the cut. So there is some additional, you do take into account some information from the full waveform, but there isn't a great deal of sensitivity to this cut.
But in your previous plot, you showed a range of masses that covered a factor of 2.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that was the contours. It goes from 50 to 100, 60 to 100 if we just do the in-spiral.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So the idea is if you then say take the most probable value for this IMR region and then say what's the ISCO frequency of this final black hole, and use that frequency as the cut.
But then when you get up to 100 solar masses, doesn't your waveform include part of the merger now?
So the waveforms do, that's why it's not simply ring down, it's post in spiral, because you do include some of the merger information. That's correct. But it's still testing the fact that, right, it is a general relativity waveform that you're using. So you're allowing the in spiral and the post in spiral part to be different. So you're still testing the consistency because in principle, right, this could match on. And as you can see, the contours are different. They do match on to different waveforms just from the data. But right, this is just due to statistical error from what we know right now, or it's consistent with statistical error. But I'd like to then sort of switch gears a little bit and then talk. Oh, you have one more question?
Yeah, ask me a question before you switch gears.
Yeah.
So why is delta M and delta A are relevant there? Are they like very sensitive to deviation from GR?
Why are these parameters?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just sort of the parameters that are sort of most easily physically measurable from the post-merger part, the final mass and final spin of the black hole that it forms. So then you're saying, okay, how different is the pre-in-spiral predictions plus numerical simulations from the post? Right, so they're just...
Yeah, so you get a good constraint on these, but can you use these to like constraint on deviation from GR, for instance?
Well, for example, if you have a theory, like scalar tensor theory, where maybe there's more radiation in the scalar modes around merger, and therefore the final mass of the black hole is different, then this would be sensitive to this kind of thing. So, this is a relatively agnostic framework. It doesn't require a specific theory, but if you have a theory that predicts a difference, it would be sensitive to this. But if you have a theory that doesn't, then, well, I don't know how you'd cook that up, but it would be effectively equivalent to GR in terms of its gravitational wave observables. Okay, so I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk now about the gravitational wave memory. And the claim is that this waveform that you've all seen is actually not the full prediction of general relativity. So what is? It's in fact, this red waveform is supposed to be equivalent to the last one, and then the blue waveform, this is what general relativity predicts. So the waveform starts at zero if you go far enough back into the past, then you end up at a non-zero value at late times. And I think it's just useful to do sort of the quick reminder that if you have your ring of freely falling test masses as your idealized gravitational wave detector, and it undergoes stretching and squeezing due to the periodic oscillation of the gravitational waves, when you don't have memory, it returns to the same shape. When you do have the memory, it returns to a distorted shape. So there actually is some information you can measure between, say, the change at early times and late times. So this is, at least in principle, a measurable effect. So the question is, why hasn't LIGO measured this? Well, if you just ask...
What you're measuring is... Can you say again what you're measuring?
Okay. Yeah, so it's this thought experiment of if you have a ring of freely falling test masses that can move with respect to gravitational waves, then you would say, let me look at the change between the initial configuration before the gravitational waves came and the final state.
So
it's distorted, and basically the amplitude of this distortion is going to be proportional to this delta H quantity. So why didn't LIGO see this? Well, if you sort of decompose into the part that they use for their templates, this oscillatory part, and then the remainder, right, you see that the amplitude of the remainder part is basically on the order of a 20th of the peak amplitude of the oscillatory part. So if you just do the signal-to-noise calculations, it was 25 for the oscillatory part, and then it was about 0.5 for this remaining memory part. And basically, this is because it's lower amplitude and LIGO is not very sensitive at low frequencies. So this constant offset here and this very slow growth here aren't really measurable.
So what's the sort of characteristic frequency of that noise?
It's determined basically by the luminosity. So how fast the luminosity, so it's going to depend on the mass. But
sure. But for like GW1509-14 or something, for example?
I guess it would be...
Sort of looks like order.
Yeah, I'm just thinking if you low-pass filter this, I guess it would be... I think if, right, when you Fourier transform this, right, basically you're just going to... The most power still is at zero frequency, and then it's just going to fall off with some power, I assume, of F. So, I think it still is the case that most power is at zero frequency, but you're just sensitive to the part that's above 10 or 20 hertz. So I think you have frequency at all scales, but the greatest power is at zero frequency still.
But you'd also expect some power at sort of the characteristic frequency of that rise time, right? Which is about, it's like 0.01 seconds or something like that.
I guess that's true.
So if you have a delta function, step function, then you do the Fourier transform, it's 1/f. So it's like 1/f starting from low frequency, and then it has some cutoff at some transient frequency showing here. So here it's like 20
hertz. But just to clarify, isn't it kind of arbitrary to separate things into oscillatory part and memory part? Because I can check kind of the physical thing is HFT. So you're separating it into two parts, but I can kind of add something to the right side and then subtract it from the left side.
I mean, so I agree. I mean, there's a sense in which it's arbitrary, but if you were to think about surrounding the source and decomposing the waveform into multipoles, then this would only be in the m equals zero modes, and this would be the m not equals zero modes. So, I mean, mathematically, yes, but yeah, physically, yeah.
M equals to zero modes.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, mathematically, yes, you can split it, but physically, yeah, I agree, you just measure the strain, so this is a little artificial, but you can at least have a template and then subtract off and there's some residual, so in principle, you can do this. All right, so the question, so the idea is that you're not going to be able to measure this from a single event, but in principle, you can measure it from multiple events, and the idea is, again, to stack. So just to sort of give you an intuitive idea of how this might work, if you define this optimal estimator for the signal-to-noise of the total gravitational wave memory across a number of events, right, you can think of it basically as the amplitude of the memory divided by its uncertainty and then normalized by this total noise over all the events, the total uncertainty over all the events. So the idea is that if you could coherently add all the memory events together, then you'd expect it to grow as root n, because this should grow as n, and this should grow as 1 over the square root of n. The one challenge is that the memory can take both signs, and actually from just the leading quadrupole part of the waveform, you can't tell. But there is information in the higher multipole moments, the gravitational wave strain. And from this, you can actually, if there's enough signal to noise in these higher modes, then you can do the coherent addition. So this is sort of what's illustrated here. The idea was you just make a simulated population of events like GW150914, and then you make many such populations and look sort of on average how fast this estimator grows. So the idea is that if you knew all the events, it would grow at this rate shown here in blue with these sort of errors over different populations. But then if you look at just the subset where you can definitively determine the sign of the response, then you can stack all the events together and you get a slightly slower growth, but still within sort of around 100 events, you can, in principle, accumulate enough signal to noise to detect the memory. So.
And so this is done with the LIGO noise curve?
This was with the, yeah, two LIGO detectors, and then the O1 sensitivity. So in fact, one thing that I'm working on is thinking about how well you can do this with Virgo and then more realistic astrophysical populations. And I'm sort of supervising a student who's master's student at Radboud who's working on this.
So where is most, like what frequency range is most of the signal coming from?
What frequency range? I mean, the low frequency, so the lower frequency LIGO is, the better and the faster you detect
this. Yeah, but I guess, I mean, there's probably some competition between the fact that the noise curve is going up very steeply at low frequency and the fact that the signal is as well. So is there some sweet spot, like, just for this particular incident?
I mean, again, it's, right, I think Juan had a pretty convincing argument that roughly this is going to fall off, like, 1 over F, so, right? Basically, if you push to lower frequencies, then you're going to do better, basically.
Yeah, but I was just wondering for this particular instrument, which where the noise curve goes up very sharply.
Where did they put the cut? I think they did.
Well, I'm just asking. 20 hertz. Where is most of the signal? What frequency range is most of the signal coming from?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's probably, let's say, 20 to 30 hertz, roughly. Right, it's the lowest part.
Okay.
Because
the LIGO definition of signal to noise is a frequency integral, not infinity,
mm-hmm.
S dot H star over the spectral density,
that's
noise
right.
density. So H is the template. So it depends on knowing the template.
That's right. Yeah.
So, but in the, for the first event, the signal is so strong.
Mm-hmm.
You can get it out of the without the template.
I mean, you can see it, but I mean, even with the first event, there was an unmodeled search, basically just using wavelets to fit the signal, and there the confidence it wasn't quite 5 sigma. So, I mean, yes, it's visible, but to really establish the confidence, you still need to do the full match filtering.
Yeah, after the match filtering bandpass, the noise of the signal is still very strong. So you can get it out of the data. So the question is whether you can do that for the memory.
So
one event is not enough.
Yeah, but I mean, if you do the signal-to-noise calculation for, suppose this is the full waveform that came to LIGO, and this is the template that you use, and you subtract it off, this is what remains, and the signal-to-noise of this was a half, no, so it's not going to be visible.
The ring down is poor.
The ring down had a signal-to-noise of maybe eight.
SON is...
Yeah, for the ring down, it was maybe a third, it was maybe around eight, but so it's still hard to see.
Let me just try to ask the punchline. So you say, well, you could do coherent stacking, mm-hmm. provided you identify the lower order multiples.
The idea is basically you need to know the sign of the detector response to the memory. So
and you're saying that each event, so in order to do the stacking coherently,
yeah.
you need to identify the higher multiples.
That's right, yeah.
And so then per event, then you're saying you have 100 of events. With 100 events, you can have a cumulative SNR mm. that would put you over the threshold
yeah.
for detection. But that means that each individual event was an event that you could recognize at higher multiples, right? So
yeah.
So it might be that the real number of events that LIGO would see is much higher than 100.
Yeah, yeah. So for example, what's shown in this curve is each X is an event they had to reject because they couldn't measure the multipoles.
Oh, I see. Okay, it's already included there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so that's the difference between the blue and the red curves here. So yeah, it's true. You cut out a fraction, but for most, you measure the higher multiples well enough that you can get the sign of the memory.
So what's needed to measure these higher multiples? You know, do you need multiple detectors? I mean, how does it work?
When in these black hole mergers, like when you decompose the waveform, the amplitude of the higher multipoles is usually significantly smaller. It gets larger as the mass ratio gets more extreme, but for an equal mass, there may be, I don't know, 10 to the 20th, something of this order. So it's just the power in these higher multipoles is weaker. Yeah, but I mean the technique is—it's still just the strain measurement, right? You still extract it directly from the strain.
So just to understand, so the dominant multiple is L equal to M equal to 2, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then this memory effect is L equal to 2, M equal to 0. Or?
Yeah, yeah. If you do think in leading post-Newtonian, yeah, it's the L equals 2, M equals 0 mode.
And then the higher multiples are higher L's, that's your thing.
Yeah, yeah, L equals 3, 4, etc. Okay, so next I sort of wanted to talk a little bit more about why the memory is something interesting and worth pursuing detection, even though it's going to be a challenge. So this is sort of a schematic description of what are the sources of the gravitational wave memory. So they kind of break down into three quantities. The first one is a little cryptically named, which I'm calling changes in conserved quantities. I'll explain that a little better later. But physically, these kinds of changes come from if you have two stars on unbound orbits and they scatter, then this can produce a gravitational wave strain constant offset. That's the memory. Then it turns out if you integrate over retarded time, the energy flux from massless particles or nearly massless particles, this again is the source of the memory. So for example, if you have a supernova explosion and you emit a lot of neutrinos in some asymmetric pattern, then this is the second source of the gravitational wave memory. And then the final one, what I showed for the binary black hole mergers, is the energy flux in the gravitational waves themselves, some higher multipole structure, and it produces strain. So it's really something very interesting, right? The memory is related to the fact that energy in gravitational waves itself radiates. So I think that alone is kind of an interesting thing to confirm, worth studying for the gravitational wave memory. Then the second reason why I think the memory is interesting is it turns out it has a close relation to asymptotic symmetries. So what are asymptotic symmetries? Well, usually people draw this Penrose diagram. In this case, this one was actually drawn by Penrose. So what is it, right? It's one where time goes upwards and then light rays are at 45 degrees. So asymptotically flat spacetimes, you can either think of them sort of as a surface all the way out to infinity, which has topology of a two-sphere, and then a bunch of null rays, which are emanating towards the interior of the space-time. Or you can think of it sort of as if you had a bunch of light rays that go out, it's sort of the endpoint of all these light rays. So then you might think the symmetry group would just be the Poincaré group, but it turns out this is not the case. It's a larger group, which gets called the Bondi-Metzner-Sachs group, because Bondi-Metzner-Sachs discovered it. So what is it? Well, it's similar to the Poincaré group in that it has the Lorentz group, but then it also has an infinite dimensional group called the supertranslations. And basically what they are is if you shift sort of the retarded time along this generator by a constant function, which is convenient, say, to decompose into spherical harmonics, then these are the symmetries. So how can you understand these? Well, it's nice to sort of think just in Minkowski space and think about what these transformations do. So if you look at the simplest case where you just have only alpha 0,0 be non-zero, so just a constant shift of all the generators, then what it does is if you take sort of a light cone that meets at a point in the center of Minkowski space, then you shift all these generators by a constant amount, and it shifts the vertex in time by a constant amount. So in that sense, you can kind of understand it as a time translation. For the spatial translations, if you think about only the L equals 1 multipoles, then right, you're basically shifting your generators by some dipolar pattern. And if you do the, if you think about this a little bit, what it does is it preserves the fact that your light cone meets at a point, but it shifts the location in the spatial slice. So that's how you can sort of understand this as a spatial translation. So then what do all the remaining generators do? Well, they're the ones where you just say shift this light cone by some different amount along every ray. So it's something like an angle dependent translation. And in fact, what it does is that disrupts the fact that all the light rays meet at a point, so now they no longer meet at a point. So they just, the light rays just hit the surface at a bunch of different points. So how does this relate to the gravitational wave memory? Well, it turns out basically the memory effect is equivalent to a supertranslation from a nice sort of initial rest frame of the system. So right, in some sense what it's saying is that the initial stationary rest frame is not unique. Gravitational waves take you to a rest frame of the final state, which is supertranslated from the initial one. So to actually measure the memory is telling you something directly about what are the allowed symmetries out at asymptotically flat, in asymptotically flat spacetimes out at infinity. So this, I think, is another very interesting theoretical reason why you want to measure the memory, that you're confirming sort of these boundary conditions related to asymptotic infinity. There's sort of another interesting reason, and that's to study the memory, and that's related to Noether's theorem. So as probably most of you are aware, Noether's theorem says that associated with every conserved, every symmetry, there's a corresponding conserved quantity. And you can formulate a slightly more general version when you have gravitational waves, which can carry off some of the conserved charges like energy. And instead of just simply being conserved, they satisfy flux laws instead. So the change in energy is related just to the flux carried by the gravitational waves. So, for example, the supertranslations, they have a conserved quantity called supermomentum, because the translations, the symmetry associated with them is linear momentum. So since they're generalization, it gets called supermomentum. And this is what I was calling cryptically the changes in the conserved quantity. So actually, when you scatter two objects in a hyperbolic orbit, you're changing the supermomentum of the space-time. So that would be very interesting to measure. But also, there's been sort of a proposal that maybe there are larger symmetry groups than the BMS group, which actually describe asymptotically flat space-times. And this was called superrotations, Basically, the idea is the Lorentz transformations are sort of the set of symmetries that would preserve this specific cross-section of null infinity. But there are a lot of additional symmetries which also do this, but they have certain singular points. So Bondi, Betzer, and Sachs originally ignored them because they thought they were unphysical. However, it turns out that if you compute the conserved quantities related to them, so just like how conjugate to the rotations there is sort of conserved intrinsic or spin angular momentum, then related to the boost symmetries, there's a conserved center of mass piece of angular momentum. So these generators sort of have two parts, sort of a super center of mass part, which turns out to contain information about the full gravitational wave memory, and then a second part, which is called super spin, which is basically a generalization of the intrinsic part of the angular momentum. And for example, this part right here, the super center of mass, it turns out to play and enroll in the proposal that there might be sort of some additional conservation laws and charges that could resolve the Hawking information paradox that was put out last year by Hawking, Perry, and Strominger. So it'd be very interesting if you could actually measure some gravitational wave effects related to these new conserved quantities that have been proposed and see if this actually is a valid notion, since there still is a little bit of doubt about whether these conserved quantities and singular generators are indeed physical. What's that?
More than a little support.
Yeah, it depends who you talk to, but yeah, there's a healthy dose of skepticism.
So can I ask kind of a general question about this? So you've derived the memory effect, talked about the memory effect in sort of a local picture. We have flux passing by, and there's a way to figure out the shift. Okay. And now you're interpreting it in terms of the asymptotic symmetries of the space-time, which for a proper compact object relativist is a perfectly reasonable thing to do, but an astronomer might look out and complain about all the mass and whatnot around. If you were to find a set of conserved charges, how much would that tell you about the local physics versus how much would that tell you about the symmetry groups, the asymptotic symmetry symmetry groups in general relativity? So, is there really a direct line? I mean, maybe I'm just ignorant between these two statements, or is this an interpretation of a calculation?
So basically, the question you're asking is, if you put the Earth, which has some mass, for example, does this disrupt the boundary conditions enough? And I think the answer is no, right? That basically the gravitational fields on the Earth are sort of on a separate length scale from those from the gravitational waves, and you can separate the two out. So I don't think there's any mixing the two degrees of freedom. Maybe if you put a black hole and then tried to measure it, I think that would be a different story. But if you have weak gravitational fields like the Earth, I don't think this should be an issue.
Cosmologically, there's real. People are trying to sort out how this is preserving the center space.
Yeah.
The picture is far from clear.
Yeah. So there have been some calculations done sort of in the geometric optics limit where you're still, in some sense, not too far, not too close to the cosmological horizon, and there it seems to hold up. But I agree that this is definitely an interesting future direction to think about, that is the gravitational wave memory effect the only sort of DC effect, or in asymptotically consider space times, are there additional effects? I think that's something that's very interesting, an idea that's worth pursuing. Okay, so I was just going to try to motivate the thing I said before of, are there quantities that you might measure related to these new conserved quantities and symmetries? So the idea is sort of an analogy, which is that when Bondi did this calculation, he derived of the symmetries, he also derived this famous mass loss formula that the change in the four momentum is basically proportional to an integral which contains sort of the energy flux carried by matter fields and by gravitational waves. But then trying to apply this same formula to the supermomentum generators, if you simply look at the change in supermomentum and say it's the change of the higher multipole moments of this energy flux, it's not the case. You need this additional term. There has to be the memory sort of term when you're thinking about these non-radiative transitions. So you need some additional term for this to be a consistent equation, the flux. So then let's think about angular momentum flux. Well, the change in the spin, for example, turns out to be related to just, say, these the Lorentz generators, which I've written in terms of the spherosauroform form, times a quantity, which is an angular momentum flux. And it turns out that you, in fact, need an additional quantity to get consistency of the change in these superspin charges. There has to be a new term, which is a certain kind of memory effect called the spin memory. So now we describe the spin memory effect in slightly more physical terms. So physically, what it turns out to be is basically instead of a change in the strain, it's a change in the time integral of the strain. And it, again, has three kinds of sources. So one will be changes in these superspin charges. So the sort of analogous thing that happens is if, say, you now have two spinning black holes that scatter and their spins precess some, and this will actually cause a change in these superspin charges. And then again, since there's sort of this flux of angular momentum, it has two components. So one would be that carried by matter fields. So for example, you have a supernova explosion and there's a lot of neutrinos that are escaping. In principle, since these neutrinos have some spin, they have some higher multipole distribution. If they're radiated asymmetrically, then this in principle could cause this spin memory effect. Although I don't know of any calculation that's actually been done.
So you mean have angular momentum rather than a spin, or you don't mean internal spin of the neutrinos?
I just mean, yeah, the neutrinos have some, or I mean, I think in principle the spin angular momentum, right? Because it's, you'd expect it to be, they have some helicity.
Angular momentum is much bigger than the internal spin.
Yeah. I mean, probably physically it would be some sort of, I mean, I don't know if this would happen, right? I mean, but presumably there might be some orbital kind of angular momentum that would have. Yeah. But then the final thing is, say, what would this look like for a binary black hole merger? Because gravitational waves also carry some flux of angular momentum. So this is something that I computed last year. And it turns out that there is an effect. So the way I computed it is just sort of within this post-Newtonian expansion in V over C. And it turns out sort of at leading order, just like how the memory appears in the standard gravitational wave memory appears in the 2-0 mode, this new spin memory appears in the 3-0 mode. And it's just related to, say, a certain combination of the leading order parts of the quadrupole gravitational waveform. And I just sort of did the calculation for compact binaries if they're orbiting at some frequency omega and then just inspiraling due to loss, gravitational wave losses. Then you can compute it, and it actually goes like the frequency to the minus 1/2 power. So in principle, right, this means as you go to very low frequencies, this could be a huge cumulative effect. And it's basically just related to the fact that if you have a binary in Newton's theory and it's infinitely far apart and it inspirals in to some finite radius, you've radiated an infinite amount of angular momentum. But obviously this won't happen in the real world. There's going to be some low frequency cutoff, so this is going to be some finite quantity. The challenge for actually trying to measure this effect, though, is that if you want to measure this with LIGO, for example, you can't actually measure the time integral of the strain, you can just measure the strain. And if you sort of run through this calculation, it turns out to be a relatively high order effect. So this is a 2.5 PN order effect, so sort of 5 powers in V over C. So I computed this effect based on my analytic approximation. And then I also looked at a full numerical relativity simulation. And as you can see, the effect is relatively small. So this is for the GW 150914 event, similar sort of parameters and distances. Now the part of the gravitational wave strain related to the spin memory turns out to be sort of less than 10 to the minus 23. So you can just do some sort of simple signal-to-noise ratio calculations. If you think about LIGO and its design sensitivity, the full waveform would have a signal-to-noise around 100. The sort of standard memory effect would be 1. And this new spin memory effect would be very much suppressed. So it doesn't look hopeful to measure this from a single event or even multiple events with LIGO. However, if you instead think towards the future, the next generation of gravitational wave detectors, like the Einstein telescope, which will be built in Europe, which is slated for the 2030s, and then will be underground and have 10 kilometer arms and be an amazingly sophisticated machine. This instead will have signal to noises, say in the thousands for the full waveform. The memory will actually stand out, right? It can have signal to noise around 30, but for the spin memory effect, for individual events, it still looks unlikely. So you basically have to play the same game of using statistics, building up a lot of detections, stacking them coherently. This is something that I'm thinking about, but obviously this is sort of towards the future.
So the numbers for LISA would be similar?
Yeah. I haven't done the calculations, but it just depends how nearby of a binary black hole, right? I mean, if you have something in the 10,000s, if you get lucky and there's something really close, then it's going to be better. It's going to be challenging.
The measured spin parameter chi factor.
That's right.
It's clustered around zero for the events.
That's right, yeah.
So it's the spin weighted vector dotted into the angular momentum.
Mm-hmm.
So either the spins are small.
Yeah.
Or they're misaligned.
Yeah.
Which do you think it is?
Which do I think it is? I think they're more likely small. It also might be an observational bias.
If small, then wouldn't that make this measurement more difficult?
No, because this is related to the orbital angular momentum of the binary. So basically, the spin effects would be a subdominant effect. That's why I'm not a huge fan of the name spin memory, but it's basically just all angular momentum. So the orbital angular momentum.
All the angular.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just the spin.
Yeah. But unfortunately, I didn't get to coin the name. I was a little too slow on the discovery. Yeah. So how am I doing on?
If you consider like binaries with like highly spinning black holes, mergers. Highly spin problems. Do you expect spin memory to be larger in those cases?
So I haven't computed this. I mean, I think in principle, because you have more angular momentum to radiate, it would be larger. But then most of this signal is actually coming from the plunge, and it plunged a little less. So that would be the argument against it. And I think we'll go with that argument for the time being. But but yeah, it's something that would be interesting to check. So. In terms of time, should I just forge ahead or?
Maybe 5 more minutes.
5 more minutes, okay. Let me think of sort of what's most interesting that I'd like to talk about. You probably have heard about the binary neutron star merger, so maybe I'll skip this. The one thing I was just gonna point out, because it's something that I was involved in, was if you just sort of get an estimate of the speed of gravitational waves versus EM, you get these sort of remarkable constraints. And there was sort of one sort of parameter in a framework for testing Lorentz violation that was improved by a factor of 10 to the 10 by this constraint, which I thought was really remarkable. And also sort of one motivation for these theories comes from from cosmology, where you sort of have these theories like the Galileans, where you have gravitational waves and light propagating at different speeds. So this one observation puts significant constraints on these kinds of theories as well. I'll skip this slide. This I think is interesting. It's just trying to explain why the observed gamma rays were so weak, right? So I'll just sort of highlight this. The observed gamma rays were, right, roughly 3 orders of magnitude lower than the previous lowest energy gamma ray detection. So One thing that I was sort of proposed to explain this is that it wasn't necessarily a classical short gamma ray burst, but it might come from a new sort of transient where the jet, instead of propagating into vacuum, propagates into dense material from the neutron star merger, and the actual gamma ray emission comes from a breakout of this choked jet from the surrounding material. And this would be one way to explain it, which looks to be consistent with sort of the radio afterglow that would come from the material running into the interstellar medium later. So this is just something that I'm thinking about mostly in terms of the rate, that if you have this new sort of emission mechanism, this could provide, you know, more GWEM counterparts than you typically expect from the short GRB. So I think maybe I'll sort of conclude with what I think is an interesting direction, which is measuring gravitational waves with astrometry. So this is a new idea. Well, in some sense old, but I think one that's going to get interesting now that there's a new astrometry mission called Gaia running. So the idea basically is old, that if you had the thought that suppose you're standing on Earth and a plane gravitational wave comes by, in principle, this will deflect the position of all the stars on the sky around you. It turns out this calculation had been done a while ago, and the deflection that you get is proportional to the strain. And the patterns that you get, so if, for example, the gravitational wave were propagating from the South Pole up to the North, this is what the Northern Hemisphere would look like, and this is what the Southern Hemisphere would look like. So it produces a very sort of characteristic pattern. And basically looking for these kinds of deflections was recently considered as a way to look for supermassive Barney black hole mergers, similar to what pulsar timing does. But sort of what I'm a little more interested in is the stochastic background from gravitational waves. So as was mentioned sort of earlier, there is this stochastic background. So the generalization, the equivalent of this map of the CMB for gravitational wave sources. So basically what the stochastic background would do is it would produce correlated proper motions of all the stars. And this is something that you could, in principle, look for. So how would you do this, and sort of what's the order of magnitude that you'd expect? Well, the correlations in the proper motion basically are going to go like the frequency of observation times the root mean square of the strain squared, which basically is Hubble's constant times this energy density in gravitational waves. So you basically take the energy density and normalize by the critical density. So the idea is, how well can you measure this? Well, it's going to be limited by how well you can measure the position of the stars on the sky, this delta theta. And then since you're correlating signals between n events, you can basically measure a root mean square strain that's sort of of order 1 over root n better. So if you're looking at frequencies, say over some time scale 1 over t, then you can get this constraint, which is of order delta theta squared divide n divide h naught t on the energy in the stochastic background. So why is this suddenly sort of interesting, since this idea is actually old and goes back to Braginsky in the 90s? Well, it's because of this current mission, Gaia, which is basically an astrometry position, which is very accurately measuring the position of about a billion stars in our galaxy, as well as 10 to the 6 quasars at cosmological distances over roughly a 5-year time period with a precision of tens of micro arc seconds. So if you plug in these numbers, then basically what you get is the constraints that you can put on the stochastic background of gravitational waves are of order 10 to the minus 8, then times sort of these characteristic parameters. So what sort of sources can you expect?
Is this for the quasars or for the stars?
This is for the quasars.
Okay.
For the stars, so yeah, why I'm interested in the quasars is basically they're at cosmological distances. So the frequencies that you'd be interested in are basically 1 over the duration of the experiment to sort of 1 over the light travel time to the quasars. So that's what I was going to show on the next slide, which is basically why I think this is a potentially interesting avenue, is that the frequency range is quite different from, you know, the current experiment. LIGO, LISA in the future, pulsar timing now, you're at much lower frequencies. And you have the potential to get constraints that are quite a bit better from the ones that you get from sort of Big Bang nucleosynthesis and correlations with the matter power spectrum.
Sorry, I don't understand. How can you go to such low frequencies? So
so basically, the approximation you work in is you just want sort of the wavelength of the gravitational waves to be short compared with the distance to the source. So if your quasars are at gigaparsec,
if the frequency is very low.
Yeah, so you're just looking for a static correlation. You're just looking between correlations that are sort of constant over the time of the proper motions of these quasars, right? They'll have some average velocity, and you're looking between or correlations of this average velocity over that are constant over the duration of the Gaia mission.
Okay.
Yeah. So the idea, though, is that right, there are the sort of current known sources are going to be the stochastic background from binary black holes, which is a little hard to see, but sort of in this range. Then I put some one sort of characteristic cosmic string model. Then, of course, there's sort of what you'd really like to measure, which is the cosmological background from inflation, I mean, the background from inflation, basically, which is many orders of magnitude lower. But since this region hasn't really been tested very well, I mean, I think there's a possibility that there might be something there that hasn't been thought of. So since the data exists, I think it's an interesting direction to think about just putting the constraints and making sure that there's no surprises there. So I guess in the interest of time, I'll skip over the last part and just sort of try to wrap up. You can always ask me questions about it later. So I hope sort of what I've conveyed, what I've sort of mostly focused on, I think, is sort of the interesting kinds of things you can do across the gravitational wave spectrum at high frequencies, both from merging binaries and particularly from memory effects. Then I think there's the potential for this new window, which will complement a lot of interesting other windows, like from pulsar timing or space-based missions, or even potentially from inflation, that you can do with Gaia and its constraints that you can begin to look at pretty soon. So just to sort of summarize, I think there's a lot of interesting questions in the field of gravitational waves, and there's time to sort of try to fill in this diagram and explore more. And I think that's something that'll be exciting to do in the future. So with that, I'll end and take any additional questions you might have.
So I guess two questions. The first, Gaia over the 5 years is attempting to get, I guess, astrometric solutions for the stars, but any one measurement isn't necessarily a 10 microarcsecond measurement, right?
Yeah, it depends on the brightness. So yeah. So that estimate might have been a little optimistic, but
I have to admit that I'm somewhat ignorant of exactly how they do what they do, but I've heard people give talks on these sorts of things, and there are all these very complicated, very large set of combined algebraic equations that they have to solve, simultaneous equations they have to solve. You mentioned BLBI here, so. Mm-hmm. The US Navy assiduously tracks quasars. Because this is what the GPS, is slave to the quasar reference frame.
Yeah.
So there are decades of at least milliarcsecond or tenth of a milliarcsecond positions for quasars.
Yeah. But how many? Is it sort of hundreds to thousands or?
I don't actually know.
Okay.
But
you may not know. Never know.
Yummy doesn't. No. But they buy up time on the VLBA, for example, to do this, and I think the data is available. We can go talk to people at the United States Navy Naval Observatory and ask them. Mm. Would that data set be enough to do some of these sorts of things? That's 100 microarcsecond. Let's pretend it's this, as good as it, you know.
I mean, so the proper motions are like 100 microarcseconds per year, kind of? Or, I mean, what are the proper motions that they're actually measuring? Because it's not simply the just the exact position, because you don't really know what the exact position of the quasar should be. So you need, it's the proper motions that you need to look at.
Actually, the key thing that they do is try to do absolute astrometry on these, right? So the quasar reference frame is solved for simultaneously. They do track. The reason why they look at them so many times is to track the proper motions and evolve the reference frame, right?
Yeah.
But this is exactly the idea behind that entire endeavor. And if they had, since they only want to know where the centers of these things are, if they had 100 microarc second measurements that extended over decades, and let's say there's you know, up to 100 of these, maybe 30 of them, would that be enough to say something?
I mean, let's just think about this estimate. Right, basically, you lose in a number by a factor of, right, 10 to the 4, but you'd gain, you said it's 30 years, so you'd gain a factor of, and then the astrometry is worse, so you lose another factor of 100 there, so you're down 10 to the 6, but then you gain through about, what, you said 4 times 20 to 30 years, so you gain a factor of 10. Back, so yeah, it seems like it would be worse, but yeah, I mean...
But you don't have to wait for Gaia?
No, but Gaia is currently running, and the next data release is in April, so...
Okay. With how many years?
With, I think, about 1 or 2 years, so it's not the full solution, but it's already getting...
2 months, can you wait 2 months?
Yeah, I mean, it's already getting interesting, and... I mean, we're actually talking, the data processing center is in Leiden, and we're talking to people there about trying to actually get this into the Gaia pipeline. So
this thing about cardiac velocities, it doesn't make too much sense to me, because, I mean, on cosmological scales, there are 10 to the minus 5 cosmological fluctuations. So I guess I was just doing it in my head. So there will be, at the level of 3 kilometers per second, there is quadrupole just from cosmological perturbations.
Do you mean just from scalar modes? Or?
Just from scalar modes, yeah. Because
then you're correlating these, right? So yeah. Like 10 to the minus 10, right? I mean, it'd be the
square. So the quadrupole in velocity field is 10 to the minus 5 is 3 kilometers per second. So...
Yeah, and then you're correlating that, so...
Yeah.
Right, wouldn't the errors go like the square, so it would be more like 10 to the minus 10, the correlated motions?
But it is the correlated motion is 10 to the minus 5. That's the picture you were showing the CMB, which, as I was saying, is the best measure thing in, best model thing in physics. It has correlations on all the scales at the level of 10 to the minus 5. So the same would apply for quasars, that they would be correlated.
But I mean, I'm not sure this... Yeah, I mean, I'm not
sure... The amplitude of the perturbation sentiment, so the power of sentiment.
But I mean, we're talking about H. Well, I guess. So,
I mean,
what is the H that you're interested in? So,
I'm interested in omega.
Or I guess if you want to say correlated velocities, what is the correlated velocity? How well do you have to measure this velocity?
The correlated. Yeah, let me just.
The proper motion, I guess that's what I'm
thinking. I mean, you know, the proper motion. Yeah, right. That would be. Yeah, right. I mean, it's sort of, you'd want 10 microarc seconds over 5 years. So the proper motions would be whatever, a few microarc seconds per year.
Yeah, I cannot do it off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's a few microarc seconds per year.
But I guess my point is, we are already measuring, I mean, correlated velocities on. Not proper motions, but I mean radial velocity. We can measure the correlations on cosmological scales.
Yeah. But these are the proper motions, and I think it would only be a nonlinear effect. So I think eventually you're right that you would have to take this into account if you actually wanted to go all the way to the stochastic background. But I think for these first constraints, I think it's not necessary yet.
Well, it seems to me that's a bigger effect than what you're talking about. But we can talk more about it.
Okay.
Okay, let us thank David again.
Thank you.